Opposition leader Anthony Albanese has delivered the first of a series of headland policy speeches, putting the party's post-election focus squarely on jobs. He's announced Labor would create a dedicated government agency to monitor workforce demands and training called Job Skills Australia. On climate change, talk of rising temperatures and emissions reduction targets has been replaced by a focus on the job-creating potential of renewable energy industries. So is this the formula to re-energise a demoralised party still coming to terms with their shock election loss? Anthony Albanese, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Patricia.
The centrepiece of your speech today was jobs. Take me through this dedicated government agency you're proposing. What would its role be?
Well, what we're proposing is a Jobs and Skills Australia. It would be modelled essentially on the Infrastructure Australia model. And what that does, of course, is bring together the different Commonwealth and state agencies, but also the private sector. We want to bring together industry and unions to do just as Infrastructure Australia plans for where capital investment should be in building infrastructure. What we need is workforce planning, and Jobs and Skills Australia would be subject to do that. At the moment, we have a mismatch between the skills that are needed and the workforce planning and training, which simply isn't happening.
Okay, it sounds like big government getting in the middle trying to organise this jobs focus. What role would government have in actually spending government money on this job creation you talked about?
Well, this isn't about money. This is about planning, getting proper workforce and skills analysis, preparing capacity studies, including for emerging industries here in Western Australia, the emerging lithium industry, for example, to have specific plans targeted at specific groups like over 55 workers. How do we retrain people? How do we train young people? And as well, in addition to that, where the government is a major funder, such as the NDIS, aged care, healthcare, the workforce planning, why is it that we don't have enough nurses to staff our hospitals? Why is it that the NDIS is growing, but there's not really a workforce plan to make sure that we have skilled workers looking after people in that sector?
You've said you want to focus on conditions for workers in the on-demand economy, the gig economy, and you're absolutely right that there are issues in the gig economy. So what sort of changes do you want to see to the industrial relations regime? Are you acknowledging that some people do want to be casual workers here?
Of course they do. And for some people, for example, Uber drivers, many adopt the platform precisely because it's flexible. And indeed, one of the things I said in the speech today was talk about how many people who work as Uber drivers have other jobs. And it can be quite good for them. But we want people to be able to choose it rather than because they don't have other options. And one of the issues that we need to look at is making sure that people can have access to things like portable entitlements. How do we deal with those issues? And with the growth in the gig economy, whereby we have something like 1.5 million people have secondary jobs at the moment, how do we make sure that issues like superannuation and entitlements are actually dealt with? At the moment, there's not really a public conversation about that. And that's what I was talking about today in terms of making sure that people, regardless of where they work, have some sense of security.
Does the nature of work in the on-demand economy mean protections for those workers should be different to those afforded to people in full or part-time work? Is that just an inevitability?
Look, in some circumstances, obviously different work will have different characteristics. But what we don't want is to, in a few years down the track, after this becomes more widespread, and the evidence is that it will in terms of the on-demand economy is growing, how is it that we make sure that people don't feel more insecure in their work, that they aren't left in a circumstance whereby they don't have proper superannuation entitlements. These are all issues that we need to have a debate about. And one of the reasons why you would do what I've done today, which is to have a vision statement about ideas, is to talk about the changing nature of society, what the role of government is in shaping that change in the interests of people.
Unions say the lack of labour market testing contained in the free trade deals you've agreed to support essentially these three deals drives down wages and promotes exploitation. How do you reconcile that with protecting blue-collar workers?
Well, the fact is that there is nothing in these agreements which will lead to less labour market testing. And that was one of the conditions that we put upon our support, and indeed there'll be more jobs created. What we have with these agreements, take Indonesia, is that Australian goods and services going into Indonesia will have 25% of them, an increase, will be tariff-free, and only 2% the other way. And the fact is that one of the reasons why the unions wanted the existing bilateral agreement between Australia and Indonesia to be abolished at the same time as this free trade agreement comes in, is that the free trade agreement provides for better protections than are currently enjoyed in the bilateral agreement, including on the ISDS provisions.
Okay, but the unions say, in fact, I just spoke to Dave Noonan yesterday, and our listeners would remember that interview on RN Drive, where he said, you've actually broken with your own policy, agreed to at national conference, which wasn't just about what you would agree to in government, but also in opposition.
Well, he's not right. The fact is that these agreements, in terms of processes, you can't have the same policy in government and opposition, because what happens is that these agreements were subject to a cabinet decision. They're actually not a decision of the parliament. The only thing that parliament had a debate over is over customs type arrangements as a consequence of the agreement that was signed off by the cabinet. It's a decision of the executive, not a decision of the parliament. And that's why what we sought to do was to provide added protections. We put forward a range of changes and commitments that we wanted, including ensuring that there's no requirement for any privatisation or indeed barrier to further public ownership as a result of these agreements. We put forward changes in terms of labour market testing to make sure there's no undermining of existing Australian award and conditions as well. These are all changes that we put forward. We secured their support. And with Indonesia going where it is to be the fourth largest economy in the world by 2050, the opportunities that will be there for Australian jobs and for the Australian economy as a result are ones that overwhelmingly the Shadow Cabinet unanimously supported, and the caucus supported as well.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvalis, and my guest is the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, who's given today the first of his headland speeches. Your speech framed climate change entirely in terms of jobs and industry instead of emissions or temperatures. Is this about signalling the economy comes before the environment?
It's about signalling that good environmental policy is also good for jobs. And the fact is that as we transition to a clean energy economy, there's enormous opportunities for job creation as a direct result of that. And we make no apologies for that. A lot of the time there's a false dichotomy given that you've got to choose the economy or the environment.
It's funny you say that, because are you creating the impression to voters too, though, that there are no consequences, that change doesn't hurt sometimes? We've seen change before, and it can hurt.
Change can be of enormous benefit if it's got right with the right policy framework. And the truth is that one of the things, for example, about renewables is that it's labour intensive. It's labour intensive in terms of production. It's labour intensive in terms of maintenance. And it can create jobs in manufacturing. And the truth is that as we transition to a clean energy economy, take, for example, batteries. Yesterday, here in Perth, I went to Mineral Resources, which is involved in the lithium sector. Now, lithium has been identified as having an enormous opportunity for growth. It's something, a resource that's required for batteries that will become more and more important. And the sort of growth that we're seeing here in WA that's been identified is an enormous positive. And I make no apologies for that. Here in WA, okay, already there's 7 operational lithium mines. There's 2 lithium processing plants.
Let me put this to you.
Built,
I'm trying to politely get in
underway.
Here, Anthony Albanese. Let me get in here. Labor talked about the potential for the low carbon economy to create new jobs during the election as well. And now in your speech, it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs. It's not like Labor didn't mention jobs. It's just that that wasn't the message that was clearly heard or believed during the election. So what will come beyond the rhetoric? What can we expect from you? Will you also provide a jobs package that will come out of all of this? Is that what you're working towards rather than just saying, hey, the new, you know, decarbonised economy will have jobs? Will there be answers for where those jobs will come from?
Well, if you have a look at the speech, Patricia, there's answers in the speech. Jobs created in lithium, for example, industry is one of the ones that we've identified. Secondly, also, I mean, not just the batteries, but Tritium, a company in Queensland, is already developing and exporting the world's fastest charging stations to Europe. We have a potential to have high-value manufacturing powered by renewable energy, and with jobs created as a direct result of that. And I've identified in a whole range of areas the growth in public transport. Today we spoke about the Bombardier factory in Dandenong, about the Downer EDI factory, which is up there in Maryborough in Queensland, and the McGowan government, all producing rail cars and rail infrastructure here in Australia, meaning jobs for Australian manufacturing.
Climate change is about the environment, though, as we're witnessing. Will your revised emissions target be higher or lower than the one you took to the election?
Well, this is the point, Patricia. We're here talking about what there's an obsession with targets. The fact is,
but
that
some of that obsession is on your own side through Joel Fitzgibbon, isn't it?
Well, the fact is that our target was set in 2015 for 2030. The next election will be halfway through that period of time. We will set targets at appropriate times based upon what's happening. And today we have an announcement that the government is actually setting up an emissions reduction task force of some sort, headed by Grant King, a recognition that they need to do something and that they need to actually have an energy policy, because at the moment they don't. And we will be working off clearly from, as a starting point, will change between now and the next election. So the idea that we would let the government off the hook and say, yep, don't worry about any clean energy policy, don't worry about reducing emissions, we'll talk to you in a few years' time, would be quite irresponsible. We want the government to work on reducing emissions now, because the more that emissions are reduced rather than increasing, which is what's happening, the better opportunity it will be from us. Okay. If we have a better starting point than the direction that it's headed at the moment.
You mentioned this appointment, as you write, reported by The Guardian, of an expert panel to find new ways to cut emissions. Will you offer bipartisanship on this approach?
Well, we haven't been approached about it at all.
But do you think it's a worthy project that it be set up? Is it a promising sign in your view?
It is a recognition that the government is failing. And that's a good thing if they're recognising that reality, because we've had the Prime Minister attend the UN and say that emissions are going down when they're clearly going up. We have a Minister for Emissions Reduction, which is an ironical title, given that he's too busy involved in other nonsense of trying to attack the Sydney Lord Mayor with dubious documents, than he is in actually doing his day job of decreasing emissions.
I've been told by some of your colleagues, I'm not saying I've canvassed every one of them, but a couple, that they'll see how you're going within 18 months. You've got 18 months as opposition leader. Do you think that's a sort of fair timeframe or prism to judge your leadership and your success as opposition leader?
I will take us to the next election and I'll be successful.
What do you make of the 18-month talk?
I don't comment on hypothetical nonsense, which no name is attributed to.
All right, fair enough. I gave it a go, and I am very thankful that you joined us on the program. Anthony Albanese, thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Patricia.
That's the opposition leader, Anthony Albanese, there. What do you make of his first Headland speech, talking, of course, about the gig economy, talking about jobs when it comes to climate change and policy, dealing with rising emissions, trying to get emissions down? 0418 226 576 is our text line.